So my paper Bible is the New American Standard Version. I typically read out of the ESV on my phone. So there's going to be some slight wording differences. So if I trip up over anything, it's probably because I'm remembering the wrong translation here. Hebrews 9. Now even the first covenant had regulations of divine worship and the earthly sanctuary, for there was a tabernacle prepared, the outer one, in which were the lampstand, the table, and the sacred bread. This is called the holy place. Behind the second veil there was a tabernacle which is called the Holy of Holies, having a golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, which was a golden jar holding the manna, Aaron's rod which budded, and the tables of the covenant. And above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. But of these things we cannot now speak in detail. Now when these things have been so prepared, the priests are continually entering the outer tabernacle, performing the divine worship. But into the second, only the high priest enters once a year, and not without taking blood, which he offers for himself, and for the sins of the people committed in ignorance. The Holy Spirit is signifying this, that the way into the holy place has not yet been disclosed while the outer tabernacle is still standing, which is a symbol for the present time. Accordingly, both gifts and sacrifices are offered which cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience, since they relate only to food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body, imposed until a time of reformation. But when Christ appeared, a high priest of the good things to come, he, through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation, and not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood, he entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer, sprinkling those who have been defiled, sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? For this reason, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that since a death has taken place for the redemption of transgressions under the first covenant, those who have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. See, there's the tripping up there. For where a covenant is, there must of necessity be the death of one who made it. For the covenant is valid when men are dead, for it is never in force while the one who made it lives. Therefore, even the first covenant was not inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment had been spoken by Moses to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you." And in the same way, he sprinkled both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry with the blood. According to the law, one may almost say all things are cleansed with blood, and without shedding of blood there is no forgiveness. Therefore, it is necessary for the copy of the things in the heavens to be cleansed with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices. For Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, a copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Nor was it that he would offer himself often, as the high priest enters the holy place year by year with blood not his own. Otherwise he would have needed to suffer often since the foundation of the world. But now, once at the consummation of the ages, he has been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And inasmuch as it is appointed for men to die once, and after this comes judgment, so Christ also, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time for salvation, without sin, to those who eagerly await him, or without reference to sin, as some translations insert. Okay, so this chapter contains a lot of phrases that are quoted quite often in various points in our worship services. Often people will go to this chapter and talk about specific sections just prior to the Lord's Supper, or it comes up a lot in invitations, right? For it is appointed for all men to die once and then the judgment. Live once and then the judgment. There's a lot of familiarity, I think, to the words in the passage, but sometimes we get tripped up over individual things. What overall, having read the entire chapter, what is the author here trying to get across? What's the big picture item?
He's telling us that until Jesus came, the sacrifice of blood was a temporary thing.
Yeah, and that's, I think, a really good way of putting it, in that you've got a temporary solution and a permanent solution, right? You've got Jesus who has done this thing once, and then the old law where he talks about these things. Now, as he talks through, I think you brought up a very important point. Were the sacrifices under the old law effective? Yeah, temporarily. And we do caveat that, right? But if we just ask the question, did God put in place a system in which his people could be right with him? Yes. Yes, I think you can read this and understand that he's not trashing the old covenant. He's not saying that it was worthless and that these things were not useful. What he's saying is it was a temporary solution. It was a copy of the things to come, and that what came after was much better. Now, why was it much better? I think we've got a couple of reasons why it was much better. And the first we've already alluded to. So we'll softball that one. I'll give you the answer. It's because it only had to happen once. What else is better in this than the previous? Okay. Okay, and that is an important distinction, but I'm even going to extend a little further on that, which is to say that it didn't happen in a specific location. The old sacrifices needed to happen at the temple or at the altars that God established for these people, which would have made it very difficult for someone like me, who lives thousands of miles away, to go and make a sacrifice, right? And so for a covenant that is going to cover a people larger than a small geographical area. Now, if we want to rewind a little bit and think about, did it make sense at the time? Well, how large is Israel? The land. At its largest, not that big, right? If you look at a map in the back of your Bible, it looks pretty big because it's been zoomed in. But if you look at a map on like a globe or a big map, you get to play one of the fun games. Having lived here now for a little over half my life, I get to play this game, which is like, how many Israels fit in Texas? Or how many of X fit in Texas, right? It's a pretty big place. But the point there is that geographically, an entire nation of people lived within relatively close proximity to one another. And so having a center of worship, having a place that was mandated for everyone to come at least once a year, at least twice a year, to come and do their sacrifices and to do the things that God had set out for them, that was not a burden that was unbearable, right? That was something that they could do. Now, what made that a lot harder? Okay, they had to walk mostly. But what sort of historical events made that much more difficult? Okay, destruction of Jerusalem, captivity before that, right? So when the Assyrians came and carried off the northern 10 tribes. Now, obviously the northern 10 tribes had very egregious issues with their worship anyway, but there were still faithful that lived in Israel. There were still few that would do this, travel down to Jerusalem. They were still trying to do what's right. It wasn't a complete nation of lawlessness. And if those people were carried away to wherever the Assyrians dumped them, now it wasn't a close geographical thing. And what made that even worse is that when the Babylonians came in and moved a large portion of the faithful that were living in Jerusalem all the way to Babylon, now you're not close and they didn't have the freedom to travel, right? So that made life much more difficult. And one of the things that the exiles had to figure out was how to continue trying to be subject to the law without access to some of the things that were called out specifically in the law. And that is something that isn't necessarily talked about in here, but is an important historical context to look at. One of the reasons why the Jews could look at something like the new law and understand inherently why it was better. Because now they weren't tied to a specific place. They weren't tied to a specific building or pilgrimage that they had to make to go do these things and to have access to it. Now, to rewind on a slightly different subject, still talking about the old law, how much agency did people have over the sacrifices that were made? In other words, how involved were the people in sacrifices for their own sins? Yeah, so their instructions came from God, so they didn't get to make up what they wanted. But as far as performing the sacrifices, how involved were they in that?
They just took it to the high priest. The high priest did it.
Well, they supplied the animal, and if you go back and read, they were the ones that were supposed to kill it. They were supposed to lay their hand on the head of the animal to symbolically transfer their sins. There wasn't anything magical going on there, but it was to symbolically understand that this animal was taking their place, and they were to slay that animal, and then the high priest took over, or the priest took over, depending on the sacrifice, and performed the rest as far as the actual preparations and burning and so forth. That was done by the priest. But there was a lot of agency. There was a lot of involvement that people had with that. How much agency do we have in the sacrifice that we are in contact with? Is it more or less? Okay, I've got some lesses. Do we have any more? Do we have any equal? Okay. Okay, I think the reason that I open this up is I think it's an interesting discussion topic, and I don't think it's something that has to necessarily have one particular correct answer. If we look at a spiritual understanding, is it easier for us to understand the spiritual implications of Jesus' sacrifice? Yes, because it is something that we look back on. It's a historical thing, and he talked about it a lot as far as it being just a spiritual thing. Was it a little harder for the Jews? Maybe in that regard, because they had a physical thing that they were slaying, and so it was more likely for them to believe that something was going on of them actually transferring sins over, as opposed to understanding that it was just a spiritual substitute that God was making. One second. But when we look at how involved people were with it, it was undeniably something that you had to see. Okay, and there is a connection, a physical connection that is made when you are there, okay, and that sacrifice is being performed. I think in some ways the Israelites may have understood a little more how serious the sacrifice was, because they had to be involved in killing that animal. They had to be there. That's an intense connection there. Now, yes, it's very physical, and so that part is harder to translate into the spiritual part. But as far as understanding the impact of what sin means, I think it was actually very important for them.
I was going to say that this goes along with what you just said. It's more personal than what it used to be, because it involves their heart.
Yeah. So,
get involved in it that way.
I agree and disagree. So I think you're absolutely correct in that our relationship to God is a little more personal, a little faster, right? Because there is no intermediary other than Jesus, right? So we go directly to Jesus and God, whereas there is the a little more separation under the old law. But if you look at people like David and the Psalms that they wrote and the personal connection that they had with God, it was still a very spiritual thing. God has always wanted his people's hearts. That has always been the point. And that's something that I think we need to get out of here is not to look badly upon the Israelites in the old covenant, because God has wanted the same thing from his people on a fundamental level. If we go read Deuteronomy 6, it's very clear what the Lord requires of people is that you love the Lord with all your heart and all your soul and all your might. That was the first and greatest commandment that Jesus said while living under the old law, right? So he brought these things up and talked about the personal connection that was necessary that you have with God. And yet, these physical things were still something that they had to go through, something that was in the way, something that was just a copy of what was to come. Yeah, and that's a good point, is that when, you know, and you see it a lot, to start with the other end of what you're talking about, you see it a lot when people are first baptized, that they're zealous for the Lord and they really are thinking about what they're doing, and the first couple of times that someone takes the Lord's Supper after being baptized, it is so special and so poignant. Because they understand, they have this zeal, they have this connection, and I think people get calloused. People grow weary of doing the right things, and that's one of the things that Hebrews is addressing, is that we not grow weary, that we not lose heart, and that we not lose our understanding of just how special these things are. And so when we read something like Hebrews 9 before the Lord's Supper, often it's just, oh, this talks about the sacrifice of Jesus, so it's appropriate for the Lord's Supper, so let's read that. But if we really read to understand what he's saying here, it should remind us of just how important it is to us that we don't have to go do these physical sacrifices. We don't have to continually think about, when the next Yom Kippur is, when the priests are going to be available to go do our sacrifices. It's done. We have instant access to it. There's no waiting. There's no, I have to take this trip to the temple to make this sacrifice before I can be clean before God. It's done. It's there. It's ready. And that is special. Yeah. Yeah, and so often you see that with, any group of people that holds something dear and then doesn't do a great job of training. That is one of the huge takeaways from looking at Israel, is that, you know, it is so easy for people to lose sight of what they're doing and why and how important it is to train people. But we're starting to get a little off topic, not off topic, but getting a little further from the chapter. So I wanted to go through a couple of other things as we're looking through here. When it talks about I had a verse about these things we can now speak into. Verse 5. Okay, I just passed right over it. Above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat, but of these things we cannot now speak in detail. What is he talking about there? Of these things we cannot now speak in detail. Yeah, they're gone, right? Where was the Ark of the Covenant? Yeah. I think Greg has the closest approximation in a government warehouse, right? But we joke about that, but really, what is likely to have happened to the Ark of the Covenant? It was carried off by Babylon, right? When Babylon came in and took over Jerusalem three times, okay? One of those three times is probably when they took the Ark off, along with all of the rest of the gold that was associated with the temple, right? There was the whole description in places like Jeremiah talking about, you know, what was going to happen, what is occurring, and the fact that, you know, just pretty much everything was stripped down. It was gone. So things like the manna and the budding rod and things that were symbolic to these people of the things that God had done for them, they were already not able to look at those things. And if you look at the temple, the second temple that was built by Herod, what was in that Holy of Holies? Not much, right? It was supposed to have the Ark of the Covenant. That was supposed to be with the cherubim and the wings, and that was supposed to be where God sat. It wasn't there. Now, was God needing a seat, a physical seat, to be there? No, obviously. That was for the people. That was a reminder for them. But that was gone already, okay? So some of the physical trappings of their religion were already broken down or taken away or just missing. And so when you look at something like this, I think the writer here is trying to remind them, even in the description before he gets to Christ, of just how different it was from when it was set up, right? So when the covenant was set up, when these things were set up, when these sacrifices were set up, they had a particular situation that didn't exist anymore. They weren't in that position. Yes, from the time of writing here in Hebrews, the Jews had come out of Babylonian exile, but not all of them. And as far as we know, the majority of people that were carried off in Assyrian captivity never came back. There were Jewish centers all around the world. There were synagogues set up for people to try to understand and have a chance to read and teach each other the law. Those synagogues wouldn't have needed to exist if everybody had still been in physical Israel. They would have been able, well, okay, they would have still existed in the cities, but not to the same level of importance, because that was the center of worship as opposed to the center of worship being Jerusalem. So when you look at something like that, when a little verse comes in there like that and says, of these things we cannot now speak in detail, how much of a physical reminder these people had of the copy that was to come, and if they hadn't done a good job of internalizing what the law meant to them, when those physical things were taken away, how much more difficult did that make it for them to really understand what they were doing and why? So when he goes on through the rest of this, remember, the author here is talking to a group of Christians. He's talking to people who have already believed. He's not trying to convince them for the first time that Jesus was the proper sacrifice, that Jesus was who saves them from their sins, right? That's not the point. And I think often we try to lose ourselves in going, okay, well, Hebrews is a proof text on how, Jesus is there to take away our sins and we don't need the old law. And you're right, but we're putting the wrong emphasis on it. What we're doing is we're trying to remind people, we're trying to encourage people, and it's trying to build up the faith to understand that they don't need the old law. They don't need to go back to it. That it has been accomplished, and there's so much better things available. It is to build up rather than break down. And I think often Hebrews is used to break down rather than build up. And I think that's important as we start going through, because as we start talking about the next section where it talks about the blood and of bulls and goats, I think people often want to go immediately and say, well, see, the sacrifices under the old law weren't effective. And that's not the point of the passage. The point of the passage is to say that they weren't as effective as Jesus' sacrifice. They did what they were intended to do. The people were able to make their sacrifices. They were able to have a relationship with God. But the next time they sinned, they had to go make another sacrifice. It was never over. It was never done. It was never accomplished. But what he says here is that Jesus, one time, accomplished it forever after that. And no one ever was going to have to go back and make another sacrifice. Otherwise, Jesus would have had to suffer multiple times. Absolutely. And that is not, it's a really good point to make, in that we still have a personal responsibility before God every time that we sin. And that is not really the point of what I'm making here. It's the actual sacrifice that has been accomplished once. And that, in other places it talks about that when we willfully sin, we again put to death the Son of God in our own consciences, right? We are treating as common the blood of Christ when we willfully ignore God's command after understanding what it is. So, yeah, none of this is to take away from the personal responsibility that we have or the spiritual journey that we have to go through as we're following Christ. But in terms of the physical sacrifice, it only had to happen once. As we talk about entering into the holy place, there's two holies, right? There's the holy place and then the holy of holies. And from a physical standpoint with the temple, it was a very clear delineation of who could go where. So who could go into the holy place? The priests. Who could go into the holy of holies? And how often? Once a year, right? Very specific circumstances. Now, under the new law, is there a holy place and a holy of holies? Trick question. Yeah, I think so. I think if you look at it from a spiritual standpoint, it does make sense to think about a holy place and a most holy place. And there is still a distinction of who goes where. Because he talks about it here in Hebrews, specifically of the Holy of Holies. Who has gone into the Holy of Holies and what is that? Christ. And what is the Holy of Holies but the right hand of God? He's gone and sat down at the right hand of God to intercede for us. Who else is going into the Holy of Holies? Nobody right now, right? That's for him and him only. Now, what does that immediately do? It immediately establishes Christ as the high priest of the new covenant, right? It goes on to put another layer on the argument he's been making this whole book about what is Christ to us. Well, he is our high priest. What is one of the jobs of the high priest? To go into the Holy of Holies and to make atonement for the whole people at that time once a year, but Christ once for all and constantly, right? So there is, again, how Christ exceeds, how he meets and then exceeds the needs of the law. What about the holy place? It was the priests, right, under the old law. But do we not all have a connection at this point, and we are all spoken of as priests at this point? So now there's no longer a distinction between the priests and then the people. The people are the priests. The people are all serving in the temple of the Lord. And where does the temple of the Lord now? But our bodies. We are the temple of the Lord. Inside our hearts, we are supposed to be acting as priests of the Most High. What does that do? Does that not present us with a sense of responsibility? That the things that we do now are public service to the Lord. Our lives themselves are public service to the Lord. It's so important that we understand what the implications are, because we can read the text and we can go, okay, yeah, the big point, and we established it in the first 5 minutes of class, right? The big point is that Christ's sacrifice once for all saves us from sin and is better than the old sacrifices that had to be performed continually. Done. Check. We now understand Hebrews 9 and can move to Hebrews 10. But that's not quite right, right? As we're going into these things, there's implications within that text that say, hey, guess what? You have a greater responsibility because now you're acting as a priest before God. Now you are living as someone who goes into the holy place. You have to be before God constantly. And that instills a greater sense of responsibility and personal agency on our part, where now we have a connection to the things that we're doing in terms of worship. Okay. Yeah.
And what you have just said gives us a greater responsibility for our own life as a Christian, as a child of God. And also, it does away or kills that way that you don't have to attend church to be a Christian. Well, you don't. But if you are a true Christian, you will be there every time the door is open, whenever it concerns the worship of God and Christ.
Yeah, and I think what you're getting to here is really just the fact that we no longer have someone that we can sort of hide behind and say, well, this person is taking care of this part of our spirituality for us. And that's always a dangerous thing to do. It's always a dangerous thing to think about. And I think even for the Israelites, it was something dangerous. And we can see people like Saul having taken that mindset and done very clearly what was wrong with it, right? Because his thought was, well, Samuel is taking care of that. I don't have to worry about it. I can go do these other things, and then Samuel can be the spiritual part for me. How well did that work out for Saul? It didn't, right? He lost his kingdom. He lost his life eventually. It took a while. But he lost everything because of his failure to accept personal responsibility for things. So even under the old law, they had to live correctly before God. They couldn't hide behind people. But now there's not even an illusion, right? There's not even that illusion for us because it is directly from us to Jesus, right? There is no person standing in between. And that's scary. That is really, really scary to a large number of people. And so I think one of the things that we see in organized religion today is that so many other groups have set up places where people can be in between you and God. If you look at what happened to the Israelites when they were at Mount Sinai, what was their first complaint? You remember what their first complaint was? Well, we want God to talk to us. Why does he always talk to you, Moses? That's not fair. So then God did. And they said, well, we were just kidding. We didn't want that. Moses, you go talk to God for us. That's not okay. Because everybody understood at that point. Everyone that was there understood the magnitude of what it meant to be directly before God. And that was too much for them. They said, nope, we need an intermediary. You get there in front of us because we need at least some sort of cover, as flimsy as it is. One person, yeah, okay, good enough for us. People do the exact same thing today. Exact same thing. If you understand what it means to stand before God, it should frighten you. It should instill a healthy sense of fear. I think one of the things that we struggle with as Christians is understanding when it's okay to be afraid. Fear is not of itself wrong. Fear is not something that we look at as necessarily a negative emotion. It's something that should teach us things. We should have a healthy fear of God. We should have a healthy fear of, I don't know, natural disasters, landslides, and electricity. Like, there's things that we look at that can kill you. It's okay to be afraid of that. And what we do with that, yeah, and what we do with that is important, right? So when we understand that God has control of our soul and that losing that is much more impactful than losing our life, then yeah, absolutely, we should have some fear there. But what we do with that, whether we run and try to hide behind someone else, or whether we learn from that and say, okay, we're going to do the things that allow us to handle this safely. We're going to do the things that allow us to have a good connection with this. And I want to actually go back to this physical example because I think it's important as we're looking through this chapter to think about. Electricity is a great example of it. Okay? Energy will absolutely kill you if you're not careful with it, right? People touch power lines and die all the time. Well, not all the time, but sometimes. It is a very clear and present danger. However, if we looked at that and said, wow, energy is scary, let's never deal with that again, we would not be seeing right now. We don't have windows in this building. At least not properly. We do kind of in the front lobby. But this place does not have windows, okay? So if we didn't have electricity running here, if we didn't have the lights running here, we'd all be in the dark, and I'd be talking to a room of I have no idea how many people. But I can count. I'm not going to right now because that would take a while. But the point is, we use electricity. We've harnessed it. We've understood it. You know what? Here's the rules. Here's what we have to do to coexist with it properly and to harness it and to utilize it for our good, and have now cultivated a healthy respect or fear of what that energy is capable of doing. So why, if we are so used to that, do you think about it when you go and flip the light switch at your house? You're like, wow, I'm messing with stuff that could kill me. No, you don't think about it. Let's be honest, you don't think about it. You just go flip on the light because you want to see. So if we're that used to something that can kill you, why is it that we spend so much time as human beings just flat out running away from God? We'd be okay. Yeah, and it really is very special because when you look at it in that context, when you look at it in what I think the Hebrew writer is trying to get across with this, is I think what he's trying to do is encourage people here. He's not trying to beat people down and say, wow, you know, that old stuff that you lived under was terrible and you should never have followed it. And by the way, this new stuff is also scary. No, what he's saying is the old law had a purpose. It had meat. It had things that should have taught you what it meant to follow God, and then to find Jesus, and then to understand what he has done is so much greater, that should bring you even closer to God. That should bring your connection to the spiritual things that God has wanted us to understand even more strongly. So when we look through, and we're running out of time here, but I want to hit one more quick thing. When it talks about verse 17 through 19, this one it continues on past 19, but when it talks about a covenant and a death and a will and those things, this is one of the sections I think that gets argued about more than a lot in the book of Hebrews. But when we're talking about this, what have we been going over but that, okay, here's a sacrifice, right? The sacrifices were signs of a covenant, right? They were things that were put in place to ratify and to enact various edicts that were put down in a covenant that God made with the people. Twice, okay? Once with the Israelite nation, and now with the world through the covenant in Jesus. And when we start talking about, okay, well, the covenant is never in effect, some translations read, a will is never in effect until the one who made it dies. Who made both covenants? God. So I think if we're looking at it as like a last will and testament, that doesn't make any sense. We're putting the wrong context on things, and what it's better to understand is the kind of covenant that was put into place in these times, okay, where it was a sovereign vassal relationship where somebody said, here's what I will do for you, and here's what you have to do for me, and that was ratified. That was put into place with a covenant victim. There was a sacrifice made that pulled into place that covenant that said, you know what, here is how serious we're being. And in fact, one of the old things was to actually cut an animal in half, and both parties walked between that animal, the two parts of that animal, to understand that they were walking in between death to ratify this covenant, that it was serious. And that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about the death of God or even the death of Moses. The law of Moses was in place before Moses died. So even if you want to put it on just the person who was putting the covenant in there, it doesn't make sense if you look at the old law in that way. You can make that kind of argument for Jesus and the new law, but it doesn't make sense as a whole analogy if you try to look at both parts. So here, it's much more reasonable to think about the way the old covenants were put into place and what a covenant victim meant. Now, under the old law, the covenant victims were those bulls, were those goats, were the things that were sacrificed to ratify the old covenant. And where it starts to get hazy is that we can make the easy last will and testament argument for Jesus because he was the covenant victim. Okay, but if we're looking in context, he is the covenant victim in this circumstance, not the, it's not a last will and testament. Now, here's why this is important, because otherwise it's just semantics and why he's been talking about this. Why is it important that it's not a last will and testament? He's not dead. Jesus is absolutely alive. Yes, he died, but when he resurrected, when he was brought back to life and ascended, to heaven, that kind of invalidates a, well, this person's dead and gone, so now we're going to enact their will, right? He's not gone. Dead, yes. Gone, no. So you can't look at it as a last will and testament because it doesn't fit the context of Jesus' sacrifice. But it does fit an ancient covenant of a sovereign, a king, and somebody who's following them. And the king says, this is what I'm going to do for you. I am going to forgive your sins, and I am going to bless you and give you eternal life and all of these things. And here's what you have to do as my follower in order to receive those blessings. That's what Jesus is doing for us. He's our king. So, bringing it back to Hebrews 9, what is he doing here? He's not just establishing Jesus as a high priest, he's establishing him as our king. And the sacrifice, right? Yeah, all those things kind of melded in one. But it's super important that we take out these implications from what was written there, because otherwise we just read over it and we say, yeah, okay, that makes sense. He's a good sacrifice. But that is what he's saying, but it's not the only thing that he's saying here. He's putting so much more meat that we can understand that Jesus wraps up so many different roles for us, and that each layer has an important connection to what we do with our lives and the responsibility that we have before him. Okay, I've taken too much time. Are there any final comments in the next 30 seconds? Okay, thank you guys so much, and hopefully Dad will be back next week and he can fix everything that I've broken.